Hello, my name is Janet Pearson Nix. I am 68 years old. Today is Wednesday, April the 13th, 2022. We are in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I am going to be interviewing Jeff Nix, who happens to be my husband of 40 years.
And my name is Jeff Nix. My age is 79. It's Wednesday, April 13th, 2022. We're here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The name of my interview partner is Janet Pearson Nix, who's also my wife.
Yes, they've heard that.
As of now.
Well, we have
Can you take it, Janet?
Lots of things we want to talk about, a lot of fun and interesting things about Tulsa. We think we both have had careers that brought us, gave us front row seats to all kinds of things going on in Tulsa, most notably a lot of the musical events that we're going to get a lot into. I come to the scene as a former reporter. I worked for the local newspaper, the Tulsa World, for 40 years. I like the number 40, it sounds like. 20 years as a reporter and 20 years as a columnist and editorial writer. And Jeff?
I grew up in Tulsa, went to Edison High School, and went to SMU and Stanford undergraduate, and then got my law degree at SMU and practiced civil rights law in Tulsa for a little over 45 years, representing women and minorities in employment discrimination cases. But I've always had music as a hobby. I've always been in bands, and I've always liked music, always liked playing, and always knew I wasn't good enough to make a career of it. So I got into concert promoting early on, and in the early 70s, a friend of mine and I, R.C. Bradley, bought Kane's Ballroom and turned it into, from the home of Bob Wills Western Swing, we turned it into a honky-tonk. And I did about 250 shows there. And then I got into, I still liked promoting, and I got drafted into doing some shows with the No Nukes anti-nuclear movement in the early 80s, and then
the late 70s.
Early 80s. Uh-huh. And then the concert came around, opportunity came around down at Greenwood and Archer, the home of really one of the worst times in American history, and certainly in Tulsa history, mm-hmm. a race massacre. And a group of people wanted to have a concert to try to bring people back to that area. And I was asked to book and produce it. And so I booked and produced it for 13 years, all of those years, Janet was with me almost every night, helping. She was, whatever I did, she did right.
We used up a lot of shoe leather. Well, in fact, it was the No Nukes movement, going back to that got us together. And this is one of my favorite stories. this was in the 70s. Throughout the 70s here in Tulsa, the nuclear power issue really got red hot. Well, throughout Oklahoma, in fact. In 74, there was the Karen Silkwood case, which a whole lot of people have heard about and probably seen the movie. She worked at a nuclear power fuel processing plant, became seriously contaminated, and it ended up being a really kind of an international story. She ended up dying under very mysterious circumstances. So that was on people's minds a lot. Then also during the 70s, around the same time, there was the announcement by the local power utility company here that they were going to build a nuclear power plant just east of Tulsa called Black Fox. Needless to say, perhaps that created a lot of controversy right off the bat. Then in the late 70s, 1979, was when Three Mile Island occurred, which was the only serious nuclear power plant incident in the country, and while nobody ended up being hurt, it did scare everybody really bad. So that was kind of the backdrop here in the 1970s. I was covering some of the health effects as a writer for the paper. I covered health and medical stuff, so I was busy you know, learning about the issue that way. Jeff was doing No Nukes concerts, quite a few of them, Washington, San Francisco, ended up in Tulsa. And as a matter of fact, that one of the Tulsa concerts is how we ended up meeting.
We did, and it's all thanks to nuclear power and Jackson Browne.
Yeah, some good.
No particular order, but I had done a show or two with Jackson that we'll get to. A couple of them were in Tulsa and so on, but we did a huge March on Washington in I think April of 79. And we had 170,000 people and some speakers and a lot of musicians, including Jackson. And by then, I'd done several shows with him. We were pretty friendly. And after the show, he said, I'd like to go back to Tulsa and do an outdoor show there. You think we can do that? And I'm going, oh, gee, Jackson, I don't know about do a Jackson Browne show outdoors in my hometown. Well, I don't know. Well, okay.
You doing the
okay, yeah, this arm's the one you twist. And I'll do it.
Okay.
So I came back to Tulsa, and I was pretty excited and decided to. I had an opportunity to go on a Sunday afternoon television show, and I did, and announced that Jackson was coming to town, and one of the viewers was...
Well, it was a Sunday afternoon. That was laundry day back then. So I was in the back of my apartment doing the laundry, folding the clothes, and had the TV on, you know, for company. And I can't tell you why exactly, but something drew me into the next room. I just something caused me to go walking in there, and I walked in there right as he was on the screen. And I looked at this guy, and I thought, I'd like to meet him. And I found a mutual friend who I knew you, and put a bug in his ear to say something, and he did. And we celebrate 40 years of marriage this year.
That's right.
So yeah, all thanks to Jackson Browne and the nuclear power issue.
and Jackson is still around, and Black Fox is a thing of the past.
And Black Fox is, yeah. So let's talk some about those concerts.
Well, you mentioned this woman, Carrie Dickerson, and she was basically had a farm over near Inola, Claremore, which is what east of Tulsa, and that's where they were talking about locating the nuclear power plant. Carrie just dug her heels in and said, I don't like the thing, and I don't want to hear. And she went to every hearing, filed petitions. She did absolutely everything that she could do. She exhausted her personal savings fighting it. And one of the things she did, she had heard that there was a group called Pacific Alliance that was doing outdoor anti-nuclear shows all over the country, and that Jackson Browne was doing a lot of the shows. So she sits down, writes him a heartfelt letter, and handwritten, and sends it. And I'm not 100% sure where she had sent it, but what address she had used. But it bounced around from activist to activist. And one of them, a local guy named John Danner, had the letter. And he heard that Jackson was doing a show in Denver, went to Denver, and went to the hotel where Jackson was staying. There was Jackson actually in the barber shop. And John trapped him in the chair and said, hey, hi, I'm John Danner, and here's a letter for you. And to his credit, Jackson, who's really a nice guy, and we'll get into that, but he read it and was quite moved by it. He said, well, let's do this. I'm on a tour right now. It ends on the Saturday before Labor Day. And how about if I come do two shows back-to-back on Sunday before Labor Day? Can you set that all up? And John went, oh, yeah, sure. And thinking, I don't know. But fortunately, he knew me and knew that I'd done Keynes and hundreds of shows. And he called me and he said, would you produce a Jackson Browne show? And I don't know. Oh, boy, I don't know. And I said, absolutely. And we selected the new Performing Arts Center, which was, I mean, new then. And it was a very, very sedate place. And it was, you know, it was for fancier folks than we, but it seated 2,500 people. And so that was the venue we chose. And a few days beforehand, a guy named Tom Campbell with Pacific Alliance, the group that was sponsoring the shows, came to town, and we met, and we liked each other. He was older than young, and I certainly was, and there was a bond there, and he'd been doing shows forever, and so had I, and we really hit it off. So we went over to the PAC, and they were pretty Pecksniffian, you know, kind of
stodgy.
Yeah, it was kind of like their living room.
Well, didn't they say no rock and roll?
Yeah,
right?
They had that in their contract, and so I said, "Well, I don't know, rock and roll, no rock and roll." He said, "Well, no drums," and I thought, "Well, that's, you know, that'll be easy because the tour, of course, Jackson had his whole band, but that was over on Saturday night. On Sunday, it was just Jackson and David Lindley, a guitar player that sings with him, and so there were no drums, but he had brought his keyboard player. And as you know, keyboards are no longer the little xylophone things. They're electronic.
Mm-hmm. With and, every kind of sound.
And during the show, the guy's name's Craig Durge. Craig was, you know, simulating different instruments. And some of them might have been drums. And the PAC guy came up to me during the concert. He was just apoplectic. Just, "God, what are you doing? I'm going to pull the plug on this show." And I said, "Oh, you're not going to do that. Come on, let's don't say that to each other." He said, "Well, you're never going to do another show in this facility as long as you live." And I'm like, wow, I've been kicked out of a public facility. Life is good. So it was the fastest sellouts ever in the history of that venue. We sold out the two shows back-to-back in a matter of minutes. And this was before computer ticket sales and all that. This was just people coming down and buying tickets. So that was really neat. And it was a great show. And one thing that endeared Tulsa to Jackson was the next morning was Labor Day, Monday. And he was heading back. He and Craig were heading back to the coast, had an early flight. So we were having breakfast at a hotel downtown that was right in the middle of town. And nobody knew except me, and it hadn't even thought about it, but you remember the great raft race we used to have on Labor Day?
And that's something that a lot of listeners won't know anything about. We have a big river running through the middle of Tulsa, the Arkansas River, and for many, many, many years, there was this really fun event called the Great Raft Race, and people who wanted to participate would go upstream on the river, 8 or 10 miles, and there was a launch point, and they'd camp out and party and everything, you know, Then they'd put their rafts in and float down the river. And, I mean, it was just a big, huge citywide party.
And these were homemade boats. I mean, you know, they would get pontoons and so on and put a platform on them. And a lot of companies got involved in it and
it
got pretty competitive.
Pretty big, yeah.
So that was the event on Labor Day. Of course, I had never been in it and only seen it once or twice, so I wasn't thinking of it. We're just having breakfast, and it's, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning. Everybody's pretty bleary, and that's interesting. You know, I'll use that word interestingly, but I kept noticing Jackson was looking out the window toward a parking lot just right across the street. And again, this is early morning Tulsa, not a soul out. And I couldn't see what he was looking at, so we're talking and talking and talking. He's talking, he's looking out the window. I said, "What is going on?" I look out the window, and in this empty parking lot, in empty downtown Tulsa, there is a trailer, you know, like a tractor trailer flatbed, and it has a raft on it with pontoons, and people are driving up in groups of one and two quietly, and these are pretty, you know, office worker type people. And they're getting out, and they've got on life jackets. And they're going over, and they're getting on this boat, and the trailer is there, but there's nothing to pull it. And so they're quietly getting on the boat and sitting, and there are probably 12, 15 of them. And, of course, I figured the raft race. But Jackson was looking at it, like, and it's clear day and all that. He's going, weather-wise, is there anything we should be worried about here?
Is there something we don't know?
No, we're all right. And again, I think he just remained uneasy until we got him out of there and got
well,
into the airport.
You couldn't come up with an explanation for that if you saw a bunch of people getting in a raft with life jackets on.
Yeah. Yeah, and as you look at it, it did look a little bit odd. But that was his first experience in Tulsa, and he thought that was pretty, and he thought Tulsans were pretty neat. You know, we all treated him well, and he's just one of the nicest human beings you'll ever meet.
That's what you have always said. Now, he did a total of 3 shows in Tulsa, and I, from a journalist point of view, I there were a lot of factors that led to the Black Fox Project being canceled. Carrie Dickerson, I'd put her at the top. This wonderful, sweet, little grandmotherly like person, and but she was so tireless. And I also think the high visibility from the shows, a lot of it here, but then you did the shows in Washington and then in San Francisco, and you got to meet your favorite author in Washington.
The neat thing about, I had been involved in the civil rights movement and freedom riders and anti-war protesters and done that sort of thing, but the No Nukes people were just really different because they had a serious mission. They wanted to do 2 things. They wanted to raise money, and they wanted to raise consciousness. And if the people that weren't around then, it's hard to imagine what the mood was like after the Vietnam War, which most people finally realized was just the power structure behaving in just bizarre ways, and the Halliburtons and all the defense contractors and all that. It was just a sham as far as having a purpose and so on. And it was so secret, and a lot of that spilled over into the No Nukes feelings, mm-hmm. because again, it was the power structure that was behind nuclear power and the government. And people were just going, geez, I don't know. I don't think we're getting the full story on this. And so there was a certain amount of paranoia about it. And then 3 Mile Island happened, and a lot of people, the almost meltdown at 3 Mile Island. And all of a sudden, Americans were going, whoa, 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 wait a minute. What is this? What is this nuclear power stuff? And so in April of
79,
thank you. we had decided to do a march on Washington. And so we had a march on Washington, had 170,000 people. And it was fantastic that it was all volunteer. And we had a permit that commenced at daybreak to bring it, to build the fence, to build the stage, bring in stage, sound and lights, all that, do the entire show, and we had to have everything torn down and out of there by dark. So at 5:30 a.m. in Washington, D.C., an absolute army of roadies and all of us just building this stage, and all day long, like I say, got 170,000 people, and 3,000 of them bussed over and were in the front row that were from 3 Mile Island from the Pennsylvania area. And it was all acoustic concert. Jackson played, and Bonnie Raitt, and John Sebastian, and
Jane Fonda was there. You got to touch her knee.
Okay.
He didn't wash his hand for like years after
that. I've these stories that come out, you never know what to think.
But we'll
of
get the author part. That's my favorite.
Well, and like I say, the entertainers. But one of the speakers was Kurt Vonnegut. And Kurt Vonnegut is my favorite author of all time. I'd never met him. He's an unusual guy. His writings are unusual. And I saw him backstage. We were outdoors, the steps of the Capitol building. And I saw him, and I thought, God, I'd love to talk to him. But I don't know. And I had talked to all kinds of artists and so on. I didn't have, you know, didn't have a fear of it. But with him, I just thought, geez, I don't know. But I looked down, and my feet were moving, and I was going over, and I thought, I don't know what to say, so I just stuck out my hand. I said, Mr. Vonnegut, my name is Jeff Nix, and I'm helping produce this concert. And he said, yeah, I saw you running around giving orders. And I said, look, I don't know what to say to you. I know people come up to you, and I don't know if you like to talk to people or talk about your stuff, but you're my favorite writer, and I've read everything you've ever written, and you're just my favorite author, but I just don't know what to say to you. And he just smiled. He said, you're doing great.
Yeah, sounds pretty good.
And I said, and Cat's Cradle is my favorite. And he goes, the Flagship of the Fleet.
And
that's the book where most of his philosophy, his real philosophy is. Mm-hmm. So we sat and talked for a couple of hours, just most ordinary conversation. And I'll never forget it. And his philosophy, I found out that he's really serious about a few things that were in that book, and I was serious about the same things, the same attitude. And he's very forgiving, he's very loving, he's very he's just a nice, patient, peaceful man. And in Cat's Cradle, the philosophy is called Bokanonism, and that's mythical, but that is his philosophy. And at the end of it, he said, well, Jeff, you're a Bokanonist. And I said, oh, and he said, oh, don't worry, I am too. And then he went up and he made a speech that I'll never forget. I mean, all these other speakers were, you had 170,000 cheering people, and so they're, do we want them? And they're like, yeah, do we want them? No. So Vonnegut gets up there, and he says, and this is almost verbatim, he says, I'm not against nuclear power as much as I'm against the people that run it. He says, they think they're so clever, but they're not. They're disgusting little monkeys, and I hate them. And he walked off, and people went, I think I understand that. And, I mean, 170,000 people.
Sort of summed it up in just a few words there. Oh, those were just some unbelievable times. It seems so far away. But it in retrospect, looking back at all the forces that went together to create the outcome that we got, it was just such an interesting time. I do want to jump over to move into the future a little bit and start talking about another one of your careers in the music industry.
The No Nukes part of it finished with the Tulsa Sun Festival, which was out at the fairground, out by the airport, out at Mohawk.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Jackson and Bonnie and Jesse Colin Young. And we had over 10,000 people there. And it was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful day. And it was a neat show. And so that was really the last of the No Nukes shows. I did, because people in the national movement were going, you know, we've had three shows in Tulsa now. You know, it is, and it's Tulsa, people. That's not, you know, one of the fancy, well-known places. So I thought, well, I'll bow out and get rid of that connection, and you guys can go other places.
Well, in fact, the power plant movement kind of came to a screeching halt. The government halted licensing for new nuclear power plants for a while, and then, you know, Three Mile Island. It's like I say, it seems so long ago, but at the time, it was a really frightening prospect for I mean, and especially if it's, you know, 20 miles down the highway from where you live.
Yeah.
So they did. They stopped commissioning them for a long time. And then in 80, what we looked it up, 85 or 6 was Chernobyl,
right,
over in Russia. And that was kind of the, because, yeah, you know, that one did cause a lot of damage. And I guess it's,
so we kind of won
back
that
in the
one.
News. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the Greenwood
exactly.
days. This is, and again, this is something that many people who aren't from the Tulsa area wouldn't know about. Although more and more, it's become a national story. The Greenwood Jazz Festival was a long running, just really a one of a kind music festival that took place for about 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the Greenwood section of town. But to understand anything about what we're talking about, we got to go back 100 years to the founding and settling of Tulsa in the early 1900s. Try to kind of summarize this real quickly, but black people in Tulsa were literally forced by an ordinance to live in a certain area of town. They couldn't live in the white parts of town. They could travel to the white parts of town to work, but then they had to go back and live in the black part of town. Not too long after that law went into effect, just about 5 years later, came, sadly, tragically, one of the worst racially motivated, it's referred to as a massacre now. It started when a young black man met up with a white woman in an elevator. Reportedly, she screamed. There were claims that he had tried to assault her. Over a 2-day period, this incident turned into just a boiling point for the city. It ended with white armed mobs heading into the black part of town, shooting, burning, destroying everything. They literally burned it to the ground. Mm-hmm. Because most structures were wood. When it was over, at least 36 people were dead, mostly blacks. Hundreds of other people were gone. It's never been known if they just left or they were killed too and their bodies were disposed of. Currently, right now, in 2022, a strong effort is underway to try to find out if there are more bodies somewhere in Tulsa. Reparations.
But the Greenwood area, Greenwood and Archer, it's just about 2 blocks north of downtown, 2 or 3 blocks north of downtown.
Was called the New
but
North.
It is north across the railroad tracks.
And then in addition, there's an interstate highway that was built that just literally cuts the town in half right there.
Right.
And this was, I didn't mention, the Greenwood area, because they were forced to live in their own little city within a city, basically. They made the best of it. They had lawyers, doctors. They had a hospital. They had stores of every kind. They had banks. It earned the nickname the Black Wall Street of America, for all the effort that they did to create their own economy. And some think that the whites didn't like that, and that was the real reason behind the burning of that area of town. Then along came a law saying, because of this awful fire, all construction now has to be concrete, brick, steel. Well, that effectively kept black people from being able to rebuild. So this area just really languished for decades. Then along came urban renewal in the 60s, cleared out the land. So you had this just huge scar of property on the near north side of Tulsa. The city leaders got the idea, maybe we could lure a university branch to go up there if we gave them the land. Well, they had the land. So anyway, long story short, they did finally get a branch of a public university here in Tulsa, Oklahoma State University. And they still found that even though it's a university, people still stayed away in droves. So the university leaders, along with some other stakeholders from that area, decided we need to figure out how to get people up here to see this area and to get interested in it and reopen it, get more stuff happening. So thus was born.
Yeah. They decided they'd do a concert. And I was practicing law with a lawyer who had his office at Greenwood and Archer, and also a guy named Jim Goodwin and his family owned the Oklahoma Eagle, which is a black newspaper. And Jim knew that I had a background in promotions, and he said, go to the meeting and take the thing over and turn it into something major. And I said, I had about, I walked a block to where the meeting was, so I had that much time to think. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you just can't do a little local, little Friday, Saturday thing, mom and pop stores and local acts. I mean, if you want to get people down here, you're going to have to get national acts. And for that, you need a huge budget. And they said, okay, great. Why don't you go raise it? I shouldn't have said that. So I thought, all right, I'll call on a couple of people I knew, George Kaiser with the Kaiser Foundation and owned the Bank of Oklahoma, and Joe Williams with the Williams Companies. I knew them just from here and there, and I pitched them, and they said, yeah, we'll put up a bunch of money. Suddenly, we had a bunch of money.
Now
and
what do you do?
So we could book anybody that we wanted. So we began to book some of the biggest acts in the world, and it was a free concert. It was outdoors, and it was just a beautiful setting. And so we got the best artists in the world, and I was producing the shows, and Janet was with me every step of the way, and we'd go to the airport and pick up the artists, and we'd pick up the trash afterwards. It was a cradle to the grave thing. And one of the artists that we went to and picked, it was Jazz Festival, but jazz is just not that big. And so we had four nights, and so we'd do jazz one night, and the other three nights would be more.
And you would always get a lot of heat over that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this isn't really a jazz festival. We know.
Yeah, really. And I'm going, really?
Not everybody likes jazz.
Oh, man, I didn't know that.
To give them an idea, can I throw out some of the, you had how many major acts, 60 or 70?
60.
Major acts. Here's something, just a list here. Ramsey Lewis, Dr. John, Little Richard, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Buckwheat Zydeco, Natalie Cole, remember her? Delbert McClinton, Cab Calloway, Dave Brubeck, Aaron Neville, Jerry Lee Lewis, that's just to name a few. And you brought a bunch of local acts who helped launch some of their careers.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of Little Richard, do you happen to remember that day we went to the airport?
I will never forget it.
What do you recall?
Oh, man. He gets off the plane. Well, you could hear him before he got off the plane. You could hear the rah, 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 rah. And he was limping so bad. He had a real bad back problem. I don't know. A lot of people probably didn't know that. So there was supposed to be a wheelchair for him, but there wasn't. Mm-hmm. So he spots this luggage cart that is wheeled, but it's not made for carrying a human being. So he goes over and tries to hop on it, and his entourage is saying, no, Richard, no. But he manages to hop on it. And
they pushed him through the airport, and he is nonstop talking. Shut up. I'm so beautiful. Take my time. Shut up. And also all the way through the sedate Tulsa International Airport.
And there's this trail of people behind
it. Conga line pushing Little Richard. And he just bop, 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 bop.
Yeah, it kind of looked like an act.
And that was Friday. And he's a very devout Seventh-day Adventist. So he cannot work from Friday sundown until Saturday sundown. And so he comes in on Friday and then he'll do the show Saturday night. So I got word late Friday afternoon that Richard wanted to go to a Seventh-day Adventist church for services Friday. And I thought, fortunately, I was able to find somebody that knew a church. So it was over on the north side, and it's a very sedate, quiet little place. And the usuals were showing up, and here comes a limo with Little Richard in it.
He was
devout, and he was very quiet during it all, but mm-hmm. it was quite a juxtaposition.
They're probably still talking about
and
that.
And the one thing, we picked him up on Saturday and spent some time with him, the sound check and all that stuff. And at one point he said, are you paid? I said, I'm a volunteer. And he said, well, what is there something we can do for you? I said, well, if I could get a picture of you and me together after the show, that'd be terrific. And he said, okay, great. So he goes up, he does the show, and the show's fantastic. And he's in an outfit that, you know, makes a neon sign look like a piece of mud. So, and then he came off. I went up and got him off the stage, and he went straight into the dressing room with all of his entourage. And I thought, well, okay, so much for the photo op. And Janet and I were backstage doing something, and all of a sudden this huge mountain of a guy comes up and he's Richard, ready for the picture. I said, okay, well, yeah, so all enough, so are we. And he came blowing out.
Yeah, in character.
Took a pic of Higgs in character.
And he kept saying, your brother was taking the picture, and he kept saying over and over, shut up, take my picture. Ain't I beautiful? Shut up, take another one. I'm so pretty, shut up.
So we got a picture, and each of us, Janet and I made poster size and in our offices.
Put it in our offices.
And so in my law office, that's the first thing the new client would see, and in Janet's editorial office at the World.
And people would come in, and the first they'd look at it, and then they'd go, is that little Richard? And I'm like, who else looks like that?
They'd come into my office and say, is that little Richard? And I'd say, which one?
Oh yeah, the guy on the right. Oh, sorry.
And I always said, you know, we were on a first name basis. He called me "Hey You," and I called him "Little."
Well, so we're about to run out of time. Let's hit a few more.
Well, Natalie Cole.
Cole was probably the biggest
bit of a turning point.
Yeah.
We had booked her it was the very beginning of a new tour for her. It was called the Unforgettable Tour, and she was going to be doing Nat King Cole's songs. And she opened the show. She would come out with the microphone, and the Jumbotron pictures on both sides were her father singing Unforgettable.
Yes.
And then she would walk out and would sing harmony on it. Mm-hmm. So all day long, people are showing up. I mean, it was just, I never saw so many people. At the end of the night, we figured we had about 40,000 people. Mm-hmm. And back then, that made us the fifth largest city in Oklahoma. So that was a lot of people. And she was so sweet and so beautiful, just like a princess, and so nice. So I walked her on stage, and she's, like I say, this is the first night of the tour. This stuff has never been done in public. She had no idea how it was going to go. She had no idea how many people were there. She had been backstage. She didn't see people coming in. So she's walking out toward the front of the stage with the microphone, and she's synchronizing, and she's watching the video, and then she steps out at the right minute, just at the right time, and she sings the first note, and she looks and sees wall-to-wall people.
Well,
I mean, 35,000, 40,000 people. That's a lot of people. And then she walks out, and she sings it, and she stops. She goes, where did you come from? And people just roar, ah! And boy, if she was wondering if the show was going to go over, there's your answer right there.
That was a very memorable.
That was a neat night. And then the last one we did was Jerry Lee Lewis, who's just my personal favorite. And he was nostalgic, caught him in one of those moments. And we were backstage or in his dressing room, and he said, you know, he was talking about the Memphis days with Elvis and, you know, Sun Records and so on. And he said, you know, all those guys, you know, all those people have died. And he said, you know, I just don't want to be the last man standing. And it was so nostalgic then. Mm-hmm. And ironically, of course, he is, you know, because the rest of them are gone. The killer is still out there killing them. But it was an interesting time to close down the festival. That was our very last.
Yeah. It served its purpose. That I think it really was one. We've estimated that, what, 500,000 people traveled up there who probably wouldn't have otherwise.
The people that don't know that area, it was like almost a buffer zone between downtown and north side. Mm-hmm. Is 4, 5, 6 block wide swath
real separate
of nothing. And now, of course, anybody that goes down there, that's the Blue Dome area. There's retail, yeah. There are restaurants, there are hotels, there are bars. There's just really every kind of activity. Now the Bob Dylan Museum is down there, the OK Pop, Canes Ballroom.
Canes is still there. And ironically, it's become so gentrified that, you know, that's caused some issues and controversy too. But I think the Black community is finally starting to get the recognition and attention that it's long overdue for rectifying those wrongs that were done so many years ago.
And I think that was a real outgrowth of, that was a real byproduct of the Jazz Festival. You hear Black people say a lot that young Black people don't have somebody to look up to, somebody that looks like them. And yet here are the best entertainers in the world. Mm-hmm. And coincidentally, most of them are Black. And that wasn't part of the idea at all. The idea was to get the kind of music, rhythm and blues, pop, and jazz.
And get people up there.
And they just happened to be Black. But to be able to show young Black kids the greatest entertainers in the world who look just like them was really, really neat. And it was such a peaceful. Well, you remember the thing you read in the paper?
Yeah, a fellow traveled from, I think he came from Indiana, and he remarked on that. He was interviewed, and he said, there's no tension in this crowd. It's really pleasant. It's really welcoming. And I've been to other jazz festivals where there was palpable tension, and that really stuck in my mind because I had noticed that. Well, we all did. You know, there was never any kind of trouble at all. Just came to enjoy the music.
Yeah, and you know, I honestly never expected trouble. Mm-hmm.
We didn't think about it.
People just seemed so grateful and so to have the best entertainers in the world free in a beautiful setting. Let's just take care of the place. And they cleaned up after themselves.
Yeah.
You know, they took the trash out, and people just really behaved well, and it was an absolute racial mix that is just a perfect replica, a perfect example of the way Tulsa is. We got a lot of great people here that get along peacefully now, and that was, I think festivals can spread peace. And I've always been proud of doing shows.
It's interesting how the backdrop of what's going on in a community or a country affects live event, entertainment events, and vice versa. And they have effects on each other. And we're still seeing some of it today. We've been really lucky.
We've had some. You know,
really interesting times, including meeting my husband, and that's near the top of the list.
Yeah, I met him. He owes me money. That's the guy, isn't it? And it's a thrill to be on this program.
Yeah,
because I talk about myself a lot and all these things I've done, but it isn't me. I'm a storyteller, and I've just run into all kinds of interesting things that have nothing to do with me.
And there may even be some kind of a book coming out of it someday.
Well, we've...
No promises, but...
Yeah, in preparation for this, we've written a lot of stuff, and going over these memories is fun, but I'm glad that we're getting a chance to preserve
it. Yeah, it was neat having a front row seat, and I want to thank NPR for making this opportunity for all the folks who have some stories they want to tell. I think it's just a wonderful concept.
And listen for us on KWGS.
In Tulsa.
Shameless plug. And thank you.